Coming up, it's all politics from NPR News.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin. And Ron, I want to advise the listener that the Democratic presidential debate not only went on this week in Las Vegas, Nevada, it ended 10 minutes ago. So we are doing a podcast immediately
in
after.
Real time. It's
That's
in
right.
real time.
That's right.
That's right. And we're in a sense, we are mentally, we are emotionally and psychologically in Las Vegas, Nevada.
And so how do you think Mike Gravel did?
Well, I would have to say Mike Gravel came out ahead in this debate because he was excluded.
He wins. That's right.
Yeah,
he wins.
Absolutely. He wins. No, seriously, what we saw tonight, The Empire Strikes Back.
The storyline from the moment, well before this debate started, was can Hillary Clinton regain the ground that she seemed to have stumbled over 2 weeks ago in the last debate in Philadelphia?
Answer seems to be yes.
Seems so. I mean,
well, she came out. She was very aggressive. She was ready.
She did not let people get away with stuff.
Right. That is exactly right. As soon as somebody came after Barack or Obama in the first case and then John Edwards, she was absolutely ready to come right back. Now, it was not just that she was prepared. Everything was prepared. They knew that Barack Obama was going to have a little bit of trouble capturing that same power and fire that he had at the Jefferson Jackson Day dinner in Iowa last Saturday night. And so when he tried to come out aggressively against her, she met him immediately. She called it mudslinging. She said it was right out of the Republican playbook. And the audience was with her.
Well, that's another thing. Not only did Hillary Clinton seem very comfortable, but the audience was... Now, CNN talked about an ostensibly non-committed, unaffiliated audience.
Oh, right.
They
yes.
seemed like to be in Hillary's
no
back
way.
Pocket.
Yeah. Well, some of them were. Some of them were in Obama's. There was no question that these people were there to rock and roll. Yeah. They wanted to respond to the candidates. They wanted to show some kind of emotion. And interestingly, there was some response when Obama began to go after Hillary, and then it turned negative. There was booing. I think that there might just have been a certain amount of preparation of that audience. Not to say that everybody was a Clinton ringer. I'm sure they were not. But those people who came to be for Hillary, I believe, were in some sense or another primed to be vocal if one of the other candidates attacked her.
And I'm not sure if the audience had anything to do with the polling data that we've seen in Nevada. But unlike Iowa, which seems to be a dead heat among Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, and John Edwards, Nevada polls, Hillary Clinton has a sizable lead.
I think she's at 50%.
Yeah.
So you could argue that the audience was simply reflective of the Democrats of Nevada. And when they saw their candidate being attacked, they reacted naturally.
What was interesting is that for the first 17 minutes, matter of fact, according to my notes, for 17 minutes, all we heard, no, I'm sorry, 19 minutes, all we heard was Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, John Edwards. We didn't even hear from another candidate.
Oh, well, and then Joe Biden finally got a chance to break in, and he had a great line.
I want Senator Biden to weigh in. Senator
oh,
Biden.
No.
I want you to weigh in.
Don't do it. No. Don't make me speak.
I want you to. Go ahead.
I love that.
And that was great.
I love that.
For about the first half hour of the debate, I think Biden made
this was at 8:19. This was at 8:19. I mean, I was counting and I said, wait a second. And Biden had the same reaction we all did, saying, is any other candidate going to get involved in this debate?
And a little bit later on when Wolf Blitzer asked everybody to pledge to support the Democratic nominee.
Wait, even before you go that far, would Bill Richardson have the same kind of reaction when Bill Richardson was asked a question?
Yes. Listen to
that. Governor Richardson, go ahead.
Well, by the way, I'm Bill Richardson. I'm governor of New Mexico. Nice to meet you all.
So, look, if you're watching this thing, you're getting a little tired of some of the predictable back and forth between the front runners, or maybe you're just getting tired of
these debates.
Which
is what the media hyped from the beginning anyway. They were playing this as a heavyweight championship fight.
The Democrats tonight, in the end, did not seem to maintain their momentum against Hillary. And I hate to go back to this, you know, Hillary holding off the boys' club dynamic, but she did have what was clearly a gender-based appeal line, which I think will be one of the things that's remembered from this debate. Let's listen to that.
I'm not playing, as some people say, the gender card here in Las Vegas. I'm just trying to play the winning card. And I understand very well that people are not attacking me because I'm a woman. They're attacking me because I'm a head. And I understand.
Ken, it seems as though the dynamic of being the only woman and the front runner is really helping her, especially at that point where she says, they're not doing this because I'm a woman. They're doing it because I'm a head.
Although she said that within days of the Philadelphia debate. I mean, first she went to Wellesley. She said those mean boys are beating up on the poor little girl. But ultimately, when that backfired on her, she said what I thought was an accurate answer. The reason they're ganging up on her, if they're ganging up on her, is because she's a head. And why not? If you're John Edwards, if you're Barack Obama, if you want to make a difference in this race, how else do you do it? By tearing down the frontrunner. It doesn't matter if Hillary Clinton's a woman or a black or a Latino or a man. The point is she is the frontrunner, and that's what you have to do if you're going to make a difference.
Here's what I'm impressed by. The Clinton campaign had a bad week or two.
Sure.
After that debate, after the Jefferson-Jackson dinner, after some negative stories in general in the
media. The planting of questions.
The planting of questions story, the waitress tip story, some other things. All of that seemed to have rocked them back on their heels a little bit. And there was a certain kind of growing criticism, maybe a little bit sotto voce, that people were saying they've lost their flexibility and their inevitability.
Right.
That they aren't adapting as fast. They don't have that same great footwork that they had in the past. And they don't know how to use Bill anymore. What I saw tonight was that they had prepared their candidate. They had prepared their crowd. They were ready for everything that everybody else was going to do. And they adapted. And they were back on top of their game.
Well, I don't know if Hillary really shined as much as you say she did, but I don't think anybody stepped up to the plate. I think that John Edwards was certainly encouraged by the reception he got in Philadelphia 2 weeks ago. I think Barack Obama as well was very...
boosted by Iowa last weekend.
Boosted by not only the polls that show him neck and neck with Hillary Clinton as John Edwards, but also how he did in the Jefferson-Jackson Day dinner. So he was also... He and Edwards were both going into this debate, I thought, with a full head of steam.
Pumped up,
exactly.
Ready to go.
But it did not happen. Once it seemed very comical and amateurish, the anger and the attacks on Hillary in the beginning. And then once that was over, once they all seemed to calm down, they seemed to lose their mojo.
So enough about the Democrats.
Thank God.
There are Republicans running for president as well, and this has been
Before we go there, can I just say one thing about Dennis Kucinich, and not because his supporters will send me emails if we don't mention him. But I thought he had a very good line when he was, of course, you know, 99 senators, I believe, voted for the Patriot Act.
All but Russell Feingold. He was the only one who voted against
it. Kucinich was obviously the only one on the stage who voted against it. And they asked him, is it true that you voted against the Patriot Act?
And he said,
that's because I read it.
And a little bit later on in the debate, Dennis Kucinich took his moment of glory and his momentum and spent it on talking about impeachment again, which is a very popular issue among Dennis Kucinich supporters, Mike Gravel supporters. And the 10 or 15% of the people in the country who thinks that's how we should spend the next year in Washington.
His comments on impeachment got standing ovation, or at least huge applause at the debate. And also Joe Biden, I thought it was interesting. He mentioned the word impeachment, too. If President Bush goes into a round without congressional approval.
Another big if.
Right.
We've had some interesting developments on the Republican side this week, too, Ken. One of those, of course, was the endorsement of Fred Thompson's campaign by the National Right to Life Committee, which is the leading anti-abortion organization in the United States, and an organization you wouldn't think would want to get within a 10-foot pole of Fred Thompson, quite frankly, because he's got much too mixed a record on abortion. He was once a lobbyist for a pro-abortion rights group. He has had a good voting record on the issue in the Senate, but he's not really an outspoken opponent of abortion so many other Republicans
are. He has said that women should not, they should not be punishments for people who have abortions.
He refuses to support the Human Life Amendment, which has been the gold standard for opposing abortion for as long as there's been a National Right to Life Committee.
But I guess it's fair to say that now that the National Right to Life Committee has endorsed Fred Thompson, it's true that the pro-life community is now united behind a single candidate,
right? No, of course it's not. They're all over the map.
You mean there are other endorsements?
They're all over the map. You've got Pat Robertson endorsing Rudy Giuliani and saying, even though he's been pro-abortion rights in the past, he's in favor of strict constructionist judges. We've got Mitt
Sam
Romney.
Bramble, right?
Being endorsed by
Paul
some
Weirich,
people.
Paul Weirich, Bob
going
Jones
with Mitt Romney.
Right?
Yeah, we're
right.
Totally confusing here.
Right.
All right. It's a big splintered field, but the surprising thing was that the National Right to Life Committee did not try to bring it all together. They brought Fred Thompson into it, an endorsement that would have to be seen as much defensive on their part as anything else. They're just trying to find somebody who will not go down in flames and take the anti-abortion portion of the party down with him.
Well, it was interesting that the endorsement came not long after the Pat Robertson endorsement of Giuliani. And there are some, there are many in the pro-life community say, wait. I understand we want to beat Hillary Clinton. I know that we want to keep the White House. But are we willing to sell principles down the river with a Rudy Giuliani who, look, you can talk about strict constructionist judges all you want. The fact is, on abortion, on gays, on guns, he is not the candidate that people, the founder of the Christian Coalition, would be likely to endorse.
It's been said again and again. It's been said on NPR and elsewhere. But the one candidate who seems to be capable of uniting social conservatives behind the Republican standard this year is none of the Republican candidates. It's Hillary Clinton.
Right.
It's opposition to Hillary, and that's what they're all counting on. Interestingly, Rudy Giuliani got his first ad out this week. And let's listen to a little bit of that.
New York City is the third or fourth largest government in the country. It's one of the largest economies in the United States. They used to call it unmanageable, ungovernable. A large majority of New Yorkers wanted to leave and live somewhere else. It was a city that was in financial crisis, a city that was the crime capital of America, a city that was the welfare capital of America, a city that was in very, very difficult condition when I became the mayor. By the time I left office, New York City was being proclaimed as the best example of conservative government in the country. We turned it into the safest large city in America.
You know, Ken, I'm going to hazard the opinion that the message that Rudy Giuliani is putting out there is almost perfectly analogous to the music you're hearing, that feel-good music in the past. What would ad makers do without piano with a lot of vibrato on it?
Well, I know, Ryan, you've always had this pianist envy about you. But what I thought was interesting is that Rudy Giuliani has always been accused of wrapping his candidacy behind the events of 9/11. And this is not, actually, this is not, there was no mention of that. And even though he said he was tested, and perhaps some people could say that might have something to do with it, and it may have.
What are the visuals at that point? I think 9/11 comes in there very clearly.
But in fairness, when he was elected mayor in 1993, beating David Dinkins, the city was a sty. It was not Bed-Stuy, but no, it was in big trouble. It was filthy. It was crime ridden. It was drug infested.
And the Yankees hadn't won the pennant in how many years? The World Series, rather?
But anyway, in 1993, when he took over, the city was in really bad shape. And when he left office in 2001, at the end of 2001...
Times Square looked like Disneyland.
It did. And now some people don't like that. But the point is, it was livable, it was manageable. And the one thing that people said could not happen happened, and a lot of people gave Rudy Giuliani credit. Now, it's unusual, the thought of a mayor of New York City, to talk about what he did in New York to get him to the White House. The point is, of course, 9/11 is a big part of it, but I thought that Giuliani, who has tried to distance himself from New York because obviously he's running more of a far more conservative than he was when he ran 8 years in New York City.
Many days now he's campaigning outside of the five boroughs.
Right. Well, there's no New York primary.
He is distancing himself.
No, but anyway, I thought that it's interesting also that we're talking about Rudy Giuliani as a nominal nationwide frontrunner. And this is the first ad he's running. And this is, you know, mid-November 2007. That's kind of interesting.
That's right. And the first voting, of course, takes place in just 7 weeks.
That's right.
Now, at the other end of the Republican spectrum of prospect, in other words, possibility of getting the nomination from Rudy Giuliani, putative frontrunner,
right,
would probably have to be somebody like Tom Tancredo, who's a congressman from Colorado, primarily associated with the immigration issue, but who got himself in the news this week by running an extraordinary and highly controversial advertisement. Let's listen to that.
Hi, I'm Tom Tancredo, and I approve this message because someone needs to say it.
There are consequences to open borders beyond the 20 million aliens who've come to take our jobs. Islamic terrorists now freely roam U.S. soil. Jihadists who froth with hate here to do as they have in London, Spain, Russia. The price we pay for spineless politicians who refuse to defend our borders against those who come to kill.
The same kind of tone that Giuliani had.
Pretty much. Except no piano with vibrato.
No.
All right. Obviously, a little bit of a tip of the hat here to the 1964 Daisy ad, LBJ, nuclear war, at the end, you know, that big, big finish. Is there any place for Tom Tancredo in these primaries? Is he going to be able to break through to get even a few percentage points?
Let me think for a second. No.
Why is that, Ken, when you consider that among all of the strong emotional issues that might cut in the Republicans' direction in 2008, among all the different issues we're looking at, anti-immigration feeling within the Republican base would seem to be one.
That's true, but we did see in the 2006 elections that various Republican candidates around the country, we saw that in Arizona with the open Jim Colby seat, we saw it in Colorado, where Republican candidates ran against illegal immigration, ran against it strongly, you know, based their campaign on it, and did not succeed. Now, there is anti-immigration sentiment, not only among Republican voters, I dare say against with Democratic voters too, but as a national issue, to be associated with one issue, I think it's just really turning off far more voters than it's attracting.
Ken, I want to put you on the spot because I have so much respect for you as a prognosticator. I want you to tell me right now who you think in 7 weeks is going to win the Iowa caucuses, especially in the Democratic Party, because I think they're going to be awfully important in the Democratic Party. And then if you want to talk about the Republicans as well, please feel free.
With the option to change my mind, I think with 7 weeks to go, I am saying in Iowa, Mitt Romney on the Republican side, Barack Obama on the Democratic side.
I am with you on both counts.
Are you?
Yes. I think that Hillary is going to ultimately stumble in Iowa. I think she's going to run a picture-perfect campaign and that people are still going to want the contest to go on. And I think that opposition to Hillary will unite around Barack as opposed to John Edwards. And we will get an actual contest for the Democratic nomination. And it's the end of the line for this week's podcast.
But you know, you can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the TL Type S with a 286-horsepower V6 and real-time traffic alerts. Learn more at Acura.com.